We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. Back in 1980, the U.S. government created a program designed to clean up abandoned hazardous waste sites. It is the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, but it is commonly known as Superfund. And over the years, it has identified tens of thousands of contaminated sites. Many have been cleaned up. As of mid-January, however, more than 1,200 sites remain on the national priority list. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk about Superfund, a little bit about the record, and perhaps talk about some of the problems associated with the cleanup of major toxic waste sites. And our guest for the program is John Applegate. He is the Walter Foskett Professor of Law at the Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. His research and teaching focuses on a number of areas, including environmental law, and he has a specific interest in risk assessment and the regulation of toxic substances and hazardous waste. He's been very much involved in advising the U.S. Department of Energy on the environmental cleanup of the nuclear weapons complex. He's the lead author of the only law casebook that deals exclusively with the statutes that regulate toxic substances and hazardous waste. He's spoken with many environmental organizations. He's testified before Congress. He's lectured to audiences around the world on these areas that interest him. And we're pleased that he could spend some time with us this morning. Questions are welcome, as always. We ask people to be brief so we could get as many in as possible, but questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We have toll-free lines, so if you're listening in Indiana or up in Chicago or any place, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. So that's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk, and that's just as it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Applegate, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate
pleasure.
It. You know, I think the thing that got us started thinking about this was something we read on the website, The Daily Beast, and perhaps you saw this or you're aware of this. What they did was they were interested. They explained that cleanup issues related to the Gulf oil spill got them thinking about hazardous waste generally and then about Superfund. So they were kind of interested in where are some of the worst places today. And what they did was they looked at the Superfund data that was available from EPA, and they made a kind of a calculation based on how bad it was and how bad each site was in terms of its toxicity, and then how many people happened to be living near it. And they came up with a list of those that they thought were the 28, I don't know why they came up with 28, but 28 worst sites. And it caught our attention, I guess, in part because two of them are in Illinois. One's in Rockford and one's in Waukegan. Three are in Indiana, and all three of those are where you are, in Bloomington, which sort of makes me wonder, well, just generally speaking, if you talk about the problem of significant hazardous waste in the Midwest, how do we, and if you set aside the issue of waste associated with nuclear weapons production, because that's kind of another whole other subject, how did the Midwest fare?
Well, the chemicals that create a Superfund site are a limited menu of chemicals, and they are chemicals that are associated with primarily industrial activities. Their dry cleaners are an exception to that. Dry cleaners often have issues with perchloroethylene, which is the dry cleaning solution, which was not always handled very well, and wood treatment facilities also seem to show up on Superfund lists quite a bit. That is, facilities that were used to treat wood against rot in various ways. So apart from those that just come to mind, the primary reason for a site being a Superfund site is that there were was some kind of heavy industrial activity involving a lot of the kinds of chemicals that are considered toxic under various federal laws. And when you start looking for areas where there was a lot of industry, especially you might think of it as old-style industry, old-style heavy industry, the Midwest and the upper Midwest, of course, are those places. That's the source of the great economic strength of these areas in the second half or most of the 20th century, and obviously also part of the problem today is the economy has sort of moved away from those kinds of industries in the U.S. So finding them for lack of a better term, rust belt, is not at all surprising. Indeed, that's exactly what Superfund was designed to address.
Mm. Well, if you set aside the issues of waste associated with producing nuclear weapons, and if you just I'm sure that there are probably other problems that don't come under Superfund. If you just look at Superfund and look at now, we've got about a 30-year record here. If you ask this question, well, how well do you think Superfund did the job that it was intended when it was enacted in 1980? How would you answer?
Well, I think I'd answer it in a couple of ways. I think in the last decade or so, I think that EPA began to become more concerned with progress than they had been. Probably even more than a decade, and began to ask itself, can we start closing out sites and getting them to the point of closure? And if memory serves, in the latter part of the Clinton administration, that became a focus. And I think that EPA has been relatively successful in closing out a lot of sites and saying, we've now cleaned them up to the level that we're going to clean them up to, and we put them on kind of an inactive list. What that means, of course, is that what's left are the really difficult ones. I mean, any priority setting like that will achieve that result. And so the most challenging sites end up being the ones that are left. And I think that's a general, at least the last that I've focused on this, that was pretty much where EPA was with the Superfund program. That is, a lot of the smaller sites have been either closed out or many sites that might at one time been thought to be appropriate for the federal Superfund program were taken over by the states in various so-called brownfields programs. And what's left for the federal government are some of the more challenging ones.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been and are sometimes even decade-long projects.
Yeah. The initial idea was that the polluter pays, that is the person or the entity that was responsible for generating the waste should be the one that should pay for it. And I understand that more than half of the cases that actually ultimately happened. Also, though, as part of Superfund, the idea was that some money was supposed to be set aside so that if no responsible party could be found to pay the bill, that there would be money to do the cleanup. And that over time, though, there has been some controversy about the mechanisms for providing that money and whether or not that money was adequate. For a time, there was a tax on oil. That then went away. I believe it was in the 90s, in the mid-90s, when the Clinton administration was in office. What can you say about the money that's been available, particularly if we're talking about sites where essentially no one can be found to be assigned the responsibility? What can you say about whether or not there's money there and where the money comes from to clean up those sites?
Right. Well, that's a really great question, and it's one of the key points of the Superfund statute. The way it worked was there was this tax. It was on oil and certain chemical feedstocks, that is, basic chemical entities. And I think that tax expired, I think, in the first Bush administration, actually, and the Clinton administration was either unwilling or unable to get it renewed. And so that there were two ways of paying for this. One was the creation of a liability system. So in that long title of the statute, that's where liability comes in. And it was about the polluter paying, but it was certainly the polluter paying in a very broad sense. That is, it cast an extremely wide net for people to be liable for it. And so, I mean, to generalize, if you'd touched the material in some way at some point, including simply arranging for it to be disposed of, then you could be liable for it. So it was the polluter in a kind of a non-judgmental sense. You didn't have to be a polluter in the sense of being a bad person or having been careless with the material or having broken the law or anything else. It was you're a polluter because you have had contact with material that ends up being released into the environment and requiring cleanup. So that was the first way of having the polluter pay and trying to return the costs to the people who had in some sense caused it, with the hope that it would create an incentive for people in the future to be more careful with these materials. And I think that has undoubtedly happened. Now, it was recognized from the beginning that you would have two situations in which the money would not be available when you needed it. The first was getting started, because often the feds would find a site. It was already leaking into groundwater or streams, or there was uncontrolled access to it, and they needed to move right away. And since the liability scheme is a litigation scheme, and that takes a long time for things to work their way through, they'd need upfront money. And the other place where you would not have money is just exactly what you mentioned, David, which is the so-called orphan site, mm-hmm. where there's either no one who is still around who has the money to pay for these rather expensive activities, or you for some reason simply can't identify where the material came from. You remember, we're talking often a long passage of time, so the key companies, the owner of the dump, what have you, could be long gone, bankrupt, no longer exist, and so on. So the Superfund was created for that initial bridge funding and for those orphan sites. What happened when the oil and feedstock tax lapsed was that the Superfund, the bridge funding, the orphan site funding, now has to be made up from just general tax funds. So the general taxpayer is paying for those kinds of cleanups rather than some industry or some actually large part of the petroleum and chemical industries.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have some callers to bring into the conversation. John Applegate is professor of law at the Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. He's a scholar of environmental law. He's done a lot of work on environmental risk assessment and policy analysis and has written many articles dealing with the regulation of toxic substances and also public participation in environmental decisions. If you'd like to join in, 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll start off here with someone in Indiana and on line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, yeah, thank you. Two things. One is, if it's a sensible question to ask. How do we compare to other countries, industrial countries, such as West Germany, for example, which is highly industrialized, in regards to cleanups? Did they take care of the problem first, as they usually do against us? And secondly, could you tell some about the litigation? Your casebook itself, I'm wondering what defense situations, what the lawyer will try to do. You talked about challenging sites. It was unclear whether that means they're just huge and mammoth to take care of, or whether or not that the litigation is so tied up that it may be years before any outcome happens. Something along those lines. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. Well, let me clarify. By challenging, I meant technically challenging. Now, some of them may be highly litigious and contested as well, but I was really referring to sites that are technically challenging to clean up. The first question, other industrialized countries, the U.S. was quite early to this, actually. And in most of the environmental areas, the U.S. was the leader. I think it's been I think that we've been somewhat overtaken, especially with by other industrialized countries. But here too, I think that when you look at most European laws that I'm aware of, and I can't claim expertise here, but that they're following either our model or at least trying to address the same kinds of things that that the U.S. has been. I know that they have active programs. Whether they've been more or less successful than ours, I do not know. I think it's probably fair to suggest that since European countries, by and large, do not have the kind of litigation system that we do, they probably operate in a more administrative way and recover costs, if that's what they try to do, more administratively and probably with less litigation. But that's really just extrapolating from the general rule about the U.S. Now, in terms of the actual litigation about these cases, the earliest cases that in Superfund, which were in the very early 80s, shortly after the act was passed, and for the first 10 years or so, the courts really worked very much on the assumption that what Congress wanted to do was expand liability as broadly as possible so that these sites, so that there would be funds to clean up these sites expeditiously. And so the courts tended to accept a very, very aggressive interpretation by the U.S. Department of Justice in these cases. So broad liability, very few defenses, and the defenses really involved having to prove that you had virtually nothing to do with the waste or with the site. I mean, it was really hard to get out of it. In the second decade or so, or maybe after 15 years, the courts began to see the other side of it. In other words, see the instances and be more persuaded by the instances where someone who had a relatively small hand in the problem itself was ending up paying a huge proportion of the cost simply because they were the person left standing. They were the only ones around who could be found or who still had funds or who weren't bankrupt or whatever, and began to read the requirements more narrowly. Without getting into the gory details of it, it really did have to do with fairly subtle readings of the requirements. The other thing that you have to understand about this whole area was that when Congress set up the liability or the litigation scheme, It didn't create a great detail. It didn't set it out in great detail. Instead, it specifically told the federal courts that they should create their own common law of Superfund liability. And so that gives the courts, and Congress specifically did this. This wasn't the court's own idea. It gives the courts a lot of flexibility. And so what you see with Superfund is really what you would expect to happen. That is, the courts start off in one direction, which makes a lot of sense in terms of the statute, in terms of the situation as presented. And over time, they begin to see that there are subtleties there that no one really understood at the beginning, and they pull back in different ways. It's a nice little case study of the way law develops through individual cases. But the main defense remains essentially causation. What I did had nothing to do with the waste. The other big defense is that you're an innocent landowner, that is, that you came to the land having no idea that this problem existed and that you had no reason to think that there might be a problem. That is, you have to do a certain amount of due diligence to establish that you really genuinely didn't know that the problem was there.
All right. We're almost at our midpoint here, and I have some other callers. We'll get right to them. Just let me introduce again our guest, John Applegate. He's professor of law at the Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. He works on areas involving environmental law, and very specifically, risk assessment and the regulation of toxic substances and hazardous waste. He's also been very involved in advising the U.S. Department of Energy on the environmental cleanup of the nuclear weapons complex, and has done a lot of writing and speaking on this subject. And we're talking this morning about Superfund and about the problem of major toxic waste sites across the country. We started thinking about this after we read something on the website, The Daily Beast, where they took a look at those that they thought were the worst Superfund sites, the 28 worst, and found two of them in Illinois. One is in Rockford, one is in Waukegan, and three were all in Indiana, and all of them in Bloomington, where our guest is. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Here in Illinois, we have the Clinton landfill that was recently approved to take PCBs. I believe it's only one of only two or three sites in the country. And I was wondering, in your risk assessment research, how well can PCBs be contained, and how alarmed should we be that this site is on top of the Mahomet Aquifer that provides drinking water for all of central Illinois?
Well, I'm not sure what form the PCBs would take, whether it's PCBs themselves or materials that contain them, or the ash from incineration of PCBs. PCBs are one of those good news, bad news kinds of chemicals. CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which are involved with ozone depletion, have the same kind of profile. What makes them really useful as chemicals is that they are very stable and they last a long time. What makes them bad as chemicals is that they are very stable and they last a long time, which means that it is that they are prime candidates for moving through the environment. And so given the opportunity, over time, they will still be around and available to move. And so when you try to deal with chemicals like that, I should add lots of perfectly natural chemicals. Elements, for example, have the same quality to them. They don't break down under natural processes. So what you need to do is with PCBs, typically the the ideal solution is to destroy them somehow so that they just don't exist anymore. You can't do that with elements so much, but and it's for that reason. They will always be around, and the more thoroughly you isolate them from the environment, the longer they will stay around. So in citing any kind of landfill or disposal facility that would have PCBs in it, one would want to be exceptionally careful to be sure that they are, that whatever the engineering is that will isolate them from, you know, the aquifer or from rain or from anything else, from intrusion, that whatever that is engineered to last for a very long time, because these things will be around for a very long time. And certainly the fact that something is above an aquifer tends to figure very heavily in any calculation of the risk or the appropriateness of siting or leaving any facility. Often, in fact, the possibility of something getting into an aquifer will be the driving fact in a risk assessment or in an assessment of the appropriateness of it. Now, I'm not familiar with this site, so I don't know how that has all developed, so I really can't comment on that site. But generally speaking, having things above aquifers requires a lot of care and concern.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Geneva next, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic, as usual. I wanted to make a comment, though, not just for companies and big corporate entities and government waste, but what about the little guy like myself and, you know, yourself? I'm a contractor. They just enacted a law in the whole country where you have to be for lead remediation. And what I mean by lead, anything in your walls, if you go to dispose of it, right now I can't find anybody that knows anything about this stuff, where it's supposed to go. Basically, you're looking at dumping it in the landfill. And I concern myself, especially me as a contractor, I try to recycle as much as I can. I've been fortunate that I've been able to recycle pretty much 85 or 90% of the stuff that I take out. But having said that, there's hardly any waste disposal stations around here to get rid of, like, solvents and paints and grass fertilizer and, you know, you name it, the stuff that we put on our lawns all the time to just chemical waste in a house. And I find it odd because everybody is talking about a Superfund. Why can't there be something for the average household waste? I see people dumping it all the time in the garbage, you know, from anything from a TV or a computer or any kind of electronics which has waste in it, even the light bulbs that you take out of your house now that has mercury in it to, you know, you name it. And I'm kind of curious on your comment. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, you raise a really great point. And to generalize the point a bit, household waste is a huge source of hazardous waste. And you've pointed to mercury, computer components, and lawn pesticide. I mean, that's a huge volume of hazardous waste. And what the typical and so if you're trying to regulate it and you're worried about it, you've got to think to yourself, well, on the one hand, this is a huge problem. On the other hand, it's going to be very difficult to get at it because it's in small amounts. The people who have to deal with it have limited time and money to deal with it separately, and it's going to be very hard to enforce. So the typical solution has been, and under the Hazardous Waste Statute, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, or RCRA, or the Solid Waste Disposal Act, deals with it primarily by saying that your regular old landfills need to be upgraded over time, but most of them are kind of grandfathered in, and there's really not a whole lot you can do about hazardous waste because we're not going to create a garbage police. Now, at the same time, as the EPA got a better handle on the industrial side of this, that is the big generators, and that became much more part of the culture. I mean, the kinds of things you're doing, for example, the recycling, I don't think people did that, 10 or 20 years ago, and I think it's because there's really been a change in culture. People think about it, they worry about it, and really are trying to do the right thing. And so what EPA and many states and communities have done is instead of trying to create some kind of trash police, is they've tried to create incentives for people either to recycle and, think about your newspapers, whatever, or to provide easy access to methods of destroying or getting rid of things like old paint or pesticides or or computers and monitors and things like that. So many communities will have a central place in the county or whatever for dealing with those materials, at least at an individual citizen level, so that kind of volume. Sometimes places here in Bloomington, a number of students worked with the local waste disposal authority to have a couple of computer waste days where they set up a station in the parking lot of our football stadium and received waste not only from the university and people in the university, but also from the entire community. So the idea is the only way we can really deal with that effectively is to make it as easy as possible to dispose of the material legally. I mean, waste oil is another perfect example of that. It's dumping waste oil down the storm sewer is really, really bad. So what states and communities have tried to do is make it as easy as possible for people not to do it because they realize that you really can't enforce it. What you've got to do is educate people about why it's dangerous and make it as easy as possible for them to dispose of it appropriately. So it's certainly frustrating, extremely frustrating, when you have someone who's trying to do the right thing and they can't do the right thing. And I would suggest being in touch with your local waste disposal agency and ask them what the options are.
Yeah. Here, and sir, as you say, some communities have had special events. We've had them here in our area where you can, there will be a day where you, there's some place you can go and you can take old electronics, or there may be a day where it's be hazardous chemicals. So that's your pesticides, your fertilizer, your paint, your whatever. And in the meantime, really the best thing I think people can do is just if they have some safe place to store this stuff, just hang on to it until that day comes, and then you'll have an opportunity to turn it in, and hopefully the big box stores, maybe they'll take back the compact fluorescents, and we'll get some kind of system set up so that there'll be ways for people to do that. But in the meantime, if people are really conscious about that, then what they're just going to have to do is hold on to the stuff until the right opportunity comes along.
Those small generators of waste, households, are really kind of the final frontier in this. And obviously what it also means is that the real way to address these issues is to find solutions that don't involve these materials in the first place. But that's easier said than done.
Let us talk with someone else. Champaign County, here where we are, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get back to the big generators, and I wanted to, just one question, in fact, is Superfund supposed to help remediate these places and then figure out the liability later? Because it seems to me that there was a lot of things that were stalled because of the fighting amongst the various corporate entities. So I gather that there's a Superfund recaptures when the litigation is done in some way. But other than that, you didn't Sheffield, which is I think the name of a disposal plant near Peoria, it's got an incredible kaleidoscopic pile of crap. I mean, it's got all sorts of medical radiation waste and all sorts of things. Maybe that's been remediated, or is it the case that it, like maybe, let's say, defense, and I'm thinking that the military is the biggest single waste generator in some ways, I've heard, and I assume it's outside of the provision of this, and that gets remediated direct from the defense spending. I think there's research at the Army Corps in Urbana-Champaign on that, but what I'm looking at is who's caveated out. If Sheffield hasn't been cleaned up, is it because it's partially nuke waste, or it's a waste disposal site? Are you getting the gist of that part of the question?
Let me take a few pieces out of this. I don't know anything about the Sheffield site, so I'll just speak generally.
Right.
The federal government, including the Departments of Defense and Energy, are covered by both the hazardous waste and Superfund laws. There are some differences from others, in part because you have the government, in a sense, regulating itself. But for hazardous waste, for example, the states actually regulate the standards for cleanup at federal facilities. That wouldn't normally happen, but there's something called the Federal Facilities FFC Cleanup Act, Compliance Act, which creates that sort of anomalous situation. So they are covered, and the fact that something has a mixture of hazardous and radioactive waste just means that it is now mixed waste as opposed to hazardous waste, and there's a whole regulatory system for dealing with that. So it's not for lack of either responsibility or for lack of rules to apply. To go back to I think the first part of it, the Superfund law itself created two kinds of response, sort of immediate ones and long-term ones, to deal with fencing sites, or if it's leaching into the groundwater, if there's something that could be done immediately about it, or controlling runoff, what have you, to get at things immediately. And was actually, Superfund was actually very good at doing those things. It's a somewhat limited universe, and those tended to be the cheaper things to do. You had a whole field or a whole bunch of leaking drums. What you really needed to do was just to get them on a concrete pad and covered up. Superfund did that very effectively. It's the long-term long-term remediation, which is much more technically challenging and much more expensive, and that's where the difficulties in litigation really would take over. I think the other thing that happened, before I described a shift in the court's approach to these things. The other thing that happened, and this happened within the first 5 years, really, of Superfund, was a quick realization that the litigation system was really not the best way to allocate the cost of cleaning up among a large, often a very large number of of potentially responsible parties is what they're called. And a number of conventions developed within EPA and the Justice Department and among the lawyers who represent the defendants of allowing the smallest contributors to cash out very quickly and with, say, a pro rata share and a small premium or just for a fixed cost, and to let and you would often get tiers of potentially responsible parties at a kind of toxic soup case like the one that you're describing. And when Superfund was reauthorized in 1986, Congress added a specific provision to allow for these settlements among the parties. And so much of the litigation is really about coming to some sort of negotiated settlement. And that can take a long time. Part of it undoubtedly is because, you know, everyone is represented and they want to protect their position as much as possible. But the other reason that it takes so long is that it's often very difficult to figure out the extent of the damage and figure out what needs to be done to address it. And there is always a danger if you make your decisions too quickly. And, I mean, this is just unbelievably frustrating, but if you do make your decisions too quickly, you can end up having agreed to a solution. Everybody's, you know, bought their way out and paid up, and all of a sudden you discover something new. Or something you didn't expect, and at that point you run the risk of the government holding the bag for that, and that can often be a lot of money. So there are both technical reasons and litigation reasons that it takes a long time. Now, is that an acceptable situation? I don't think I'd go that far, because I think having you call them transaction costs, having the litigation costs of this system be so high doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because that's money that could be spent on actual cleanup as opposed to debating about the cleanup.
Just on that last point, what can you broadly say how much is actually consumed in transaction and legal liability disputes over the actual remediation? Is there any sort of way of characterizing that?
I'm sure that that's been studied, and I just don't know the answer to that. My guess is that it varies widely from site to site, and there's an organization in D.C. called Resources for the Future, which has done some really terrific work in analyzing the policy behind Superfund. Really very good work. And you might go to their website. It may be just rff.org, but it's Resources for the Future. And if anyone's done a credible study about that, they're likely to be the people who did it.
Well, thanks a lot. I hope that the decision wasn't final about that PCB disposal site in the aquifer here. Thanks a lot.
All right. Sure. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus, and our guest is John Applegate. He's professor of law at the Indiana University School of Law, Bloomington, and his area of expertise is environmental law, particularly risk assessment and the regulation of toxic substances and hazardous waste. And that's what we're talking about. We started specifically talking about Superfund and the problem of major industrial toxic waste sites around the country and what sort of progress has been made, say, now over the 30 years that Superfund has been around. At questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's something that's come in as an email. It's a kind of a specific question. I don't know if you'd be able to respond, but the listener says that in recent years, while walking along some local railroad tracks, that he's noticed used creosoted ties, railroad ties, just tossed into adjacent ditches, and was wondering about whether that was legal and what law might apply to that, and whether you would have anything to say about or could say about what how something like that, like an old railroad tie, would how it's supposed to be disposed of.
Well, I can't be very specific about it just because I don't know enough about the situation.
Sure.
But I have the same question. In the creosoted ties are a problem. They creosote, or what's called creosote, for wood treatment purposes, has a lot of dangerous compounds in it, and just dumping them along the side of a ditch does not strike me as the ideal way to get rid of them.
Let me ask another question. It's something that I know that you're interested in, and I also know that it's complicated, but I'm interested in this question of how it is that a substance comes to be officially considered to be hazardous, and whether in fact there are there might be some circumstances under which we'd have some collection of things that clearly are toxic and clearly are accepted to be hazardous, and that then maybe that would be subject to law, and that there might also be some assistance in cleaning things up. But are there other things that some people believe are hazardous, but for some reason, as far as the law is concerned, they're not considered to be hazardous?
Most stuff is covered in what I think it's fair to say that most toxic materials are covered in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Now, there for any given substance, there is sometimes a bit of a patchwork of different ways that they're regulated under different statutes. I mean, instead of having one gigantic environmental statute, so to speak, we have different ones that are generally based on different mediums. So, there's an Air Act, there's a Water Act, there's land contamination, which is solid waste and Superfund. Industrial chemicals are regulated in a different way, and that doesn't have to do with the environmental media. It has to do with them being a chemical. So there's sometimes a bit of a patchwork. Superfund really tried to address that problem. Superfund is the last of the really major environmental laws to be passed. As you mentioned at the very beginning, David, it was passed in 1980, and most of the other big ones were passed from the early to mid-70s. And so in defining a hazardous substance for its purposes, it really incorporated by reference materials that were regulated under other statutes, and virtually all of the other major environmental statutes. So it pulls things that are considered hazardous waste or hazardous air pollutants or toxic water pollutants pesticides and so on and so forth. The big exclusion from Superfund, though, is petroleum and petroleum products, which may seem a little strange given that petroleum was one of the things that was taxed to create the Superfund, mm-hmm. that big bridge fund that we talked about before. But that's because petroleum and petroleum products tend to be basic feedstocks for lots of other chemicals. So that's the big exception there. On the other hand, petroleum is covered under the hazardous waste law, and the hazardous waste law has its own cleanup provisions. So it's pretty rare, I think, to find something that is just unregulated. The problem is more often that it's regulated in what seems like and is an unnecessarily complicated way.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder again, here we have about a minute, but whether we still go on the principle that says if you're trying to establish something as potentially hazardous, that somehow it's up to the person who thinks it's hazardous to establish it and not to whoever produced it to establish that it's not.
Well, if it's a listed hazardous substance, then it is. And if it's found in the configuration that's covered by Superfund, then you would really have to prove that you didn't have something to do with it. But once it gets on those lists, then it is regulated that way.
Yeah. Well, we're just about the point we have to conclude. I guess I'm wondering if overall can one say that we've actually now over the last 30 years made significant progress?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Is there a lot more to do? And some of the hardest work is still to be done, but we've absolutely made a lot of progress. And as the gentleman who was the contractor was saying or indicated, there's been a huge culture change in the way we handle these materials, and that's probably at least as effective as anything else we've done.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose also, too, we should mention, I wouldn't want people to get the idea that, Superfund was created and we had this big list that was put together in the 1980s and that slowly we've been ticking things off that list. It is the case that as time has gone along, new things have been added to that list. In fact, I think that there are today sites that are up for consideration to be considered to be Superfund sites.
That's absolutely right.
And how many do you know?
Oh boy, the number declines over time, of course, because Superfund is mainly dealing with larger sites, and so it's rarer today to find something altogether new. But I think most of the worst ones have been identified probably long ago. But it is it's an ongoing process. There's no question about it.
All right. Well, there we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, John Applegate. He is Walter Foskett, Professor of Law at Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. And Professor Applegate, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.